in Perek Yud Beis, chapter 12, the beginning of the Perek, very exciting, and it's the part of Yiftach's story that people ignore. Basically, once he has done whatever it is that he did with his daughter, whether it was sacrificing her or sending her out to be a hermit, you've jumped the shark. There really isn't anything else that you can do that's going to impress anybody. Nonetheless, Yiftach is going to. Yiftach is going to top himself. It's going to fit the whole story that we're going to see. It's a short story. It's just seven psukim. It's going to fit the general theme that we outlined in chapter 10 when we started talking about Ammon and Yiftach. People who are trying to do something good, but they do it in a warped way. And David, that's a great shirt as well. I think we can agree on that one. So in this case, the people who are trying to do something good, we think, are Yiftach and the tribe of Ephraim. But both of them end up doing bizarre things. And I should warn you before we start reading this story, there are no heroes in this story. There are only villains of varying degrees. That's it. And the same can be said for later stories in Shoftim, but in particular in this story, as we're going to see, there really are no heroes. So let's read the story. It's the first seven psukim in Perek Yud Bet in chapter 12. And then we'll try to understand something of what happened. So this is after the war. Remember, we talked about this a little bit last week. We said that the story with Yiftach's daughter coming out of the house and all of that and the whole resolution of that story plays out after the events of chapter 12. Chapter 12 is actually the end of the war. Vayitzaek ish Ephraim vayavor tzafona. The people of Ephraim rallied and they moved north. That's what it sounds like at any rate here, although the Dat Mikra says it's actually not going north, but they go to a city that is called Tzafon. Interesting. Okay. Vayomru, how do your translations render it? Oh, you know what? I see it. I have it in my notes. I missed it in my own notes. Rashi says it's to the north. Interesting. Sorry, what are you going to say?
No, I'd say cross to the north in my edition.
So yeah, that's following the read of Rashi. We'll talk more about this. I forgot that I had something in my notes on this. We'll actually talk more about this in a little bit. But let's go through the story. Fine. They go Tzafona, whatever that means. They went to the winery in Niagara. Vayomer li Yiftach, and they said to Yiftach, Madua avarta lihilachen bivnei Ammon, velanu lo karasa lelachas imach. What's this business where you go fighting Ammon and you didn't call us to go with you? Beischa nisrof alecha bo'esh. We're going to burn your house down. That's the people of Ephraim. Not, wow, thank you so much for fighting this war on our behalf. Not, let's make you a leader. But rather, we're going to burn your house down. Okay, now, this story may sound somewhat familiar, right? Because we've seen this before. With the people... I'm sorry? Well, it does. Burning it instead of blowing it down. But this story should remind us of Gidon with Ephraim, right? If you go back to chapter 8, the beginning of the chapter, after Gidon has won the initial battle against Midian, but still he's still pursuing them, the people of Ephraim come to him and they say, what is this? You didn't call us to fight Midian? And it says there, Vayrivuni to b'choska. They fought him powerfully. They're really, really angry. And the response that Gidon had in chapter 8 was, whoa, wait a minute, you guys are amazing and wonderful. What we do is nothing compared to what you do. You're amazing warriors. Well, that's not Yiftach's approach, which is kind of funny, because he was such a diplomat when he dealt with Ammon. Instead, Pasuk Beis, Vayomer Yiftach Aleihem. Yiftach said to them, Ish Riv Hayisi, Ani Ve'ami Uvnei Ammon Me'od. He says, you know, I just fought a really hard battle, me, my people who are with me, against Ammon. Ve'ezakeshem, and I did call you. V'loho shatem osim yadam, and you guys were useless. You didn't come help me. V'arekin chamoshia. I saw you were good for nothing. You didn't save me. V'asima nafshi b'chapi. So I put my life in my own hands. V'ebarael b'nei Amon. And I crossed over to Amon. V'yitzneim Hashem b'yadi. And God put them into my hands. God was the one who did this. So I called to you. You didn't help me. I called God, and God helped me. V'lama ali semela yamazeli lachem bi. Why are you fighting with me? Now, to this point, it's just diplomacy, right? Where you been? What's going on? I was there. My whole nation was there. My allies were there. Where have you been? But now, vayikbots Yiftach es kol anshei Gilad vayilachem es Ephraim. Yiftach gathers all the people of Gilad and goes to war against Ephraim. Vayaku anshei Gilad es Ephraim, and the people of Gilad strike Ephraim. Ki amru plitei Ephraim atem. Gilad besoch Ephraim besoch Menashe. That is a very hard sentence to translate. We're going to need to come back to this sentence. Right now, the way we'll read it is simply that they strike Ephraim and they say something about them. And we'll have to figure out what it was that they said, because the sentence in the Hebrew is not at all clear. Vayokod Giladis Mabaros Hayardein LeEphraim. Not only do they strike Ephraim, but also they take all of the crossings of the Yarden, so that Ephraim can't get across. Meaning Ephraim has crossed the Yarden east to go yell at Yiftach. They now want to go back home. The people of Gilad are holding the crossings. And Vayaki Amru Plitei Ephraim Avora, when people from Ephraim said, I'd like to cross, Vayomru lo anshei Gilad ha'Ephratiata. The people of Gilad said, are you from Ephraim? Vayomru lo. And they would say, oh no, not me. I'm not from Ephraim. Ooh, I don't look like anybody from Ephraim. Vayomru lo. And they said to him, to this person who wants to cross, Emorna shibolet. Say the word shibolet. Vayomer sibolet. But they couldn't say it. They would say sibolet instead. We're going to come back to that. V'lo yachin l'daber kein. He couldn't say the word right. V'yochzu oso, and they took him. V'yishchatuhu el mabaros hayardein. They shechted him. They would kill a person into the crossing of the Yarden. V'yipol b'yisahim e'afrayim arbo'im u'shnayim aleph. The 42,000 casualties from Ephraim, all told. Vayishpot Yiftach es Yisrael shei shanim. Yiftach is a shofet for 6 years. Vayomas Yiftach ha-Giladi. He died. Vayikaver ba'arei Gilad. And he was buried in the cities of Gilad. There's your story. Okay. So what here would you like to ask about besides what in the world was he thinking? Yeah, why can't they say Shibolet, right? I think that's a legit question. Why the personal threat to Yiftach's house?
Yeah.
I mean, what's that about? So, you know, as I said before, sorry, David?
Also, the ending, after such a brutal behavior on Yiftach's end, it almost sounds like a compliment by Yishpot Yiftach at Israel, Sheshani.
Yeah, he goes on to be a shofet. Like nothing's wrong.
Like, you know, and he died, and he was buried, and everything was good.
Yeah, this is just a note in his biography. He killed 42,000 people from his own country, and he was a shofet for 6 years.
Yeah.
Okay. Next. what does the next shofet do for an encore? It's such a bizarre story. You know, for Yiftach, at best, and this is what Abarbanel does, at best, Yiftach is defending himself from bad people who threaten him. At worst, as we're going to see in Midrash, he is an arrogant brute who pays for this with his daughter's life, right? Well, that was what we saw in the Midrash that said that what happens with his daughter is a punishment because of what he does to Ephraim. But Ephraim also, at best, and again, Abarbanel and Malbim present the best way to look at them, they're offended people who overreact. At worst, and Ralbag reads them this way, they're jealous, they're ungrateful, and they're insulting people. So, the first question I'd like to look at is, what's wrong with Ephraim? Like, why are they the ones who are picking fights with the leaders? They did it with Gideon, and now they're doing it with Yiftach. Like, what exactly is in the water in Ephraim land? Not only that, but think about this. What tribe was Gideon from? You remember? Sorry?
Menashe,
correct. Gideon was from Menashe. We talked about that because of the relationship between Midian and Gideon, and that we tied that back to Yosef being sold by the Midianim. So Gideon is indeed from Menashe. And what tribe is Yiftach from? Yiftach HaGiladi? Menashe. He's from Menashe as well. So Abarbanel says that's the deal. They, if you take a look at source number one on the sheets, he says, Lefisha Gilad hayala chatzi shevet ha-Menashe. Gilad belongs to the part of Menashe that's east of the Yarden. Umilavad hayos Ephraim u-Menashe achim, shaya ra'ui sheyaziru ish elachiv. First of all, that means they're brothers, right? Ephraim and Menashe are brothers, and they should have helped each other. Hine odaya gavul Ephraim samuch aleihem, and they're also side by side geographically. Hayara ui shebnei Gilad yikru achehem bnei Ephraim ashchenim aleihem lahaloch lihilachem bnei Amon. So Gilad should have called Ephraim, saying, "Hey, let's go fight." Vine chashvu bnei Ephraim shalom isabaze ashma veavon lanshe Gilad. They're not angry at Gilad. They're angry at Yiftach personally. They think this was his decision. They think Yiftach is an arrogant man. And that's why their complaint is specifically to Yiftach. And to him they said, "We're going to burn your house down." Because it was about him. That's the way that Abarbanel reads the story, is that, you know, we share a boundary. We're close brothers. You should have called me. The same argument they made with Yiftach. You should have called me. That's the, that they made with Gideon. The difference only between Gideon and Yiftach, I guess, is that Gideon calms them down, and Yiftach does not. Malbim, though, adds another dimension to this story. He says, yeah, they're brothers. You know that really nice Dvar Torah that people like to tell about why we say to our kids, Yisimcha Elokim ke'Ephraim v'chim Menashe? Right? Why do we bless them specifically to be like Ephraim and Menashe? What's the usual answer you hear people say?
The first time that brothers are not jealous of each other, even though the bracha was given to the younger.
Right, well, these are the first two, even before you get to the bracha being given to the younger, but just in general, siblings in the Torah don't do so well. We finally get two brothers who get along. Right, there are other answers that are given. They grew up in Galus, and yet they stayed loyal, and there are other things you can say. Well, Malbin says, actually, not so much. This goes back to the bracha, is what the Malbim says. Take a look at source number two. V'ratzu l'srof beiso, they wanted to burn his house. Ki lo eskimu al nesiuso, they didn't agree that he should be the leader in the first place. They weren't buying into that. V'hayala, and as he says, there's evidence for that in Pasuk Dalet, in sentence four. In sentence four, we're going to come back to sentence four, and this whole thing about who are you and who is Ephraim and who is Menashe, we're going to have to see more about that. But he says that Ba'ala Matana, their argument was Shayu Gedola mi Menashe beis Yosef. We are greater than Menashe in the house of Yosef, because the pasuk says David alluded to it. Vayasem es Ephraim lifnei Menashe. Ephraim was put in front of Menashe. Yaakov gave the bracha to Ephraim first. We are Ephraim. We should be going first. And you should not have the leader. And that was their complaint. So it's a bigger complaint. It's a complaint of brothers. Not just a complaint of, why weren't we summoned for the battle? But we're supposed to be on top. So they go to Safona. which again Rashi says is they go north. Da'at Mikra says they go to a city called Safon. And the way that the Da'at Mikra reads it is they were on their way to Mitzpah, which is where he lives, but along the way they met his men and they gave that that complaint. I think that he's getting that he's reading that from what happens further in the story, which is Yiftach. If you read through the Psukim in Perek Yud Bet, you hit Perek Pasuk Dalet 12:4, and you find out Yiftach gathers the Anshei Gilad. How in the world does he gather the Anshei Gilad if he's face to face with Ephraim and fighting with them? So you could say this is just a response over time. But I think what the Da'at Mikra is gaining here by saying they weren't actually face-to-face with him is that then it explains how he's able to generate this this response, because they're not actually there. They're talking to people who are his agents. So Yiftach replies, right? Yiftach says to them, Abar Ben El says he says three different things. He says, first of all, it was Ani Ve'ami. My people and I were fighting, meaning it wasn't just my decision. Remember, Barbanel thinks they're blaming him personally. It wasn't me alone. It was an Ivi Ami. It was me and my whole group. Number one. Number two, Va'ezak, we did call you. And number three, Va'itzneim Hashem Biyadi. God wanted me for this. God gave me victory. Right? Remember that he said to the people of Ammon, you get whatever land your God gives you. So, he says, God gave me this. But Yiftach does not respond with the diplomacy that we saw him do with Ammon. Right? There's no diplomacy there. So, this is what's highlighted by the Medrash that we saw last week, which condemns him for this very brutal response. In fact, Professor Rosenson, who we've quoted a couple of times, says that this closes the loop with Avimelech. Remember that Avimelech was, of course, very brutal. And then after Avimelech, we had these two stories of Shoftim, brief stories of Shoftim. Was it Tola and Yair? And it looked like there was an attempt to kind of move away from that style. But he's a throwback. If you take a look at source number 4, Dr. Rosenson writes, Gam Eitzel Yiftach et Cholola Milchemes Achim Azah. Also with Yiftach, you have a powerful fight of brothers, Shaisa Krucha B'Shvichus Damim Merubah, involving great bloodshed, just like Avimelech had. He says, you can't free Yiftach from responsibility for it. So this view, like the view of the Medrash Tanchuma, which I brought you in number 3, but we saw last week, is that Yiftach is just a brutal man. Pin it on Yiftach. But Abarbanel says, not so fast. He says, realize that the people of Ephraim spoke differently to Gidon. When we compared this to Perek Chet, it was a little bit different. In Perek Chet, we said, let's go back and take a fast look at it. The people said to him, Ma davar hazeh asisa lanu, what have you done to us? Levilti karos lanu, not to call us? Ki alachta lehilachem b'midyan, you went to fight Midyan? And then it said, Vayrivuni to b'chuzka, they fought with him powerfully. Whereas here, their statement to him is, Madua avarta lilachem bivnei Amon v'lanu lo karas alach hazimach, why did you go fight them and not call us? So far so good. But then they throw in, we're going to burn your house down. So Abarbanel says, you can't really expect diplomacy when you threaten to burn someone's house down. That's just not a thing. If you take a look at source number 5 on the sheet, he says, V'hine lo ra Yiftach lefayes bidvarm levnei Ephraim k'mo sha'asa Gidon aleihem. Yiftach does not take the approach of appeasement as Gidon did. Vasi baba ze etzli, he says, you know what I think the reason is? L'vishem dibru l'Gidon, b'lashon rakayim ha'yosim bim riva. They spoke politely to Gidon, even though they were angry at him. Aval Yiftach amru miyad batchila, v'ischan esrof olach ha'ba'ish. With him, they threatened to fight and to burn his house down. I think this is consistent with Abarbanel's general approach to the Shoftim. Right? Remember, Abarbanel is of the view that Shoftim are fundamentally great. He was even willing to somehow defend Avimelech and say, well, he killed his brothers, but that was before he became the Shofet. So here, he's giving you a positive spin on Yiftach to say, well, after all, you know, they did threaten to burn his house down. Like, you can't really forget that. Okay. But let's get to that pasuk that I keep saying we need to explain.
Sorry, could I?
Yeah, please, David.
Ask his second answer to them, I did call you.
Yeah.
Do we see anywhere? Do we see that he did indeed call them and didn't call a general call to anybody who wants to fight?
So, he was brought in to lead everybody, right? That was his starting point, was that he was brought in to lead the fight. He went with the Ziknei Gilad in chapter 11, sentence 11. Then he did his whole diplomatic mission, which took us all the way to chapter 11, sentence 29. And then we're told that he had the spirit of God upon him, and he crosses or goes through Gilad and Menashe, takes the vow, and then we're told that he went to fight against them. But we aren't really given details about the war. We talked about last time the fact that this story does not seem terribly interested in the war. It's much more about all the other things that are going on. So the answer is, we don't see him actually issue a call, no. So, this pasuk here, sentence 4, I mean, I'm willing to give him that and say he called them and it just wasn't reported here. I'm willing to take that as given. But how do you read this pasuk in pasuk Dalet? Right? It starts out easily enough. Yiftach gathered the people of Gilad and fought with Ephraim, and the people of Gilad struck Ephraim. But the rest of the sentence, for they said, you are refugees of Ephraim, Gilad in Ephraim in Menashe. I don't know what that means. So I'll give you two different approaches, hinging on the meaning of the word ki. What does the word ki mean? In general, what does the word ki mean?
Because.
Can mean because. What else can it mean?
If. It has four meanings. It could be if, him.
So the Gemara talks about about multiple meanings for the word ki. The one meaning is because, as was stated here. Another one is when. Like kaasher. So one approach, which is the approach of the Targum, and it's the approach of Rashi, is that ki here means because. Whereas the Da Mikra offers us an approach, and there's a similar idea in Radak, which reads ki as when. So the first approach is that it's because. And the insult that's going to be read here is Ephraim insulting Gilad. Okay, so Gilad is attacking Ephraim, and Ephraim is insulting Gilad. And what they say to them is the following. Ki amru plitei Ephraim, the people of Ephraim said to them, right, because the refugees of Ephraim said to them, Atem, you are Gilad, within Ephraim, within Menashe, meaning you are low-class people. You're inferior. You are just rabble, you Gilad people. Whether you are in Ephraim or whether you're in Menashe, nobody respects you. And that is what Malbim took before as evidence of Ephraim believing themselves superior to Menashe. They're superior to Menashe, and they're superior for sure to Gilad. So the way to read the line is, they fought with Ephraim, they struck Ephraim because, you know what the refugees of Ephraim who were there were saying? They said, you Gilad people. You're low class in Ephraim, you're low class in Menashe, you're low class all around. Whereas the other way to read it is to read it as when. And the speaker is not Plitei Ephraim. The speaker is actually Gilad when they catch the people of Ephraim. So the way to read it is, they struck Ephraim, ki amru, because they, the people of Menashe, the people of Gilad, said. to those people who were pretending to be a Menashe so that they could cross the river, they said to them, Plitei Ephraim atem, you are from Ephraim, you're refugees of Ephraim. Gilad, if you are Gilad at all, it's Besoch Ephraim. You are Gilad of Ephraim, which now is within Menashe. You follow? It's a little bit of a hard read, I have to say. It is consistent with the fact that in Pasuk Hey, they're going to, again, be referred to as Plitei Ephraim, the refugees of Ephraim. But the either this was an insult from Ephraim towards Gilad, or this was Gilad's insult to the people of Ephraim who were pretending to be from Menashe. Okay? Are we clear? Somewhat clear? Okay. So now we get to this shibboleth, which I expect you're familiar with, you know, in English is used that way as well. Right? The word shibboleth is a reference to a password in English. Never heard of that? Nope. Okay, good. We're learning something. Yes, if you were to look it up online, you'll find shibboleth is used to mean a password, and it obviously comes from the story here. Why in the world did you pick this story? This word, I should say. So clearly, it's the shin sound versus the samach sound that they're having trouble with. So Radak says this wasn't the only word. This was just an example. They would get them into a conversation. They would get them to say a word that had a sh sound in it. They would pronounce it the way they did back home, which was with an S sound. And they said, aha, you are Plitei Ephraim. Right? That's Radak's read of it. Rashi, though, says, no. We have a phrase, comes up in Tanakh a bunch of times, shibolet hanahar. A shibolet is when you have grain, right? It has like this braiding to it at the top of the grain. So when a river has that kind of flow where you start to see like the little channels within the water that are, you know, go sort of interweaving, it looks like the braiding that occurs in a stalk, and so it's called shibboleth hanahar. So Rashi says, they catch them at the river, and they say shibboleth, like the river there. That's the way that that Rashi explains the choice of words. But the big question you have to ask, as Michael asked, is, so why couldn't they pronounce it? Like, how hard is it to make a sh sound? So Radak says this really funny thing. Radak says it could be it's a function of climate. He says it could be a function of climate, and he writes that that's like French people who have trouble with the sound tough. I don't know what he's referring to. I don't know anybody who has trouble specifically with the sound of the letter tough. But that's the way that Radak reads it, that this was the problem that they had. I'm just calling up the Radak on my computer here, and then I'm going to share it with you so you can see it, because I didn't bring it on the sheet. But this way you'll see it. So, at the bottom there is the Radak. I'll just move that out of the way. You see Shibola, where my arrow is? So first he says, Kemosha yuminasino sam bezos hamila, kena yuminasino sam b'chol mila sheyesh bo shin. Right? Radak says they tested them with this word and with other words that have a shin. And then he says, Shayu, where the arrow is again, Shayu megamgamin ba'osa hashin. They had trouble pronouncing that shin. Ulai haya avir artsam goreim lahem zeh. Maybe the air of their land caused it. Kamo anshei tsarfat, like the people of Tsarfat, sheinam mevinim lekro hashin. Oh, so it's not the tough that has a problem for them. Sorry, that's a mistake in my notes. They have trouble saying shin, v'korin osa kamo tav rafa. They say it like a soft tough, like a soft. So apparently, in France, in the time of the Radak, there was some issue with people being able to pronounce the sound of a shin. I don't know. But he believes that maybe it's a climate issue. Radak is a long time ago. Radak is the end of the 12th century, beginning of the 13th century. But that's the that's his take on it. Rabban Zion Uzi, yeah. Sorry?
This must have been before the days of speech therapy.
Yes, they needed speech therapy. If they had had speech therapy, then this...
Life.
Yeah, that's very important. Speech therapy can be life-saving. The other view that I've seen, Rabban Zion Uziel dealt with this question. Rabban Zion Uziel was a major halachic authority in the middle of the 20th century. And he dealt with many questions about communities that were merging in Israel, pre-state and then early state, and how to deal with issues like davening. And what do? In terms of nusach, you're davening in a shul where they pronounce things one way, you pronounce it another way. So along the way, in his tshuva, which is the first tshuva in Orach Chaim, in this first volume of Mishpatei Uziel, he quotes Rav Sadia Gaon, who says what I think linguists today believe to be true, which is that they lived among people who didn't use that sound as one of their phonemes in their language. Right? In other words, people tend to migrate to the sounds that are used by the dominant population in their area. And the sounds that aren't used in their alphabet, the sounds that they don't generate, tend to fall away from others who live in that land as well. So the obvious example of that is the Gimel. Right? The Gimel and the Ayin, where it's generally accepted by many halachic authorities that the Yemenites are the ones who do it the way that it was originally done. So the Gimel has, unless it has a Dagesh in it, is like a Gimel. And the Ayin is a guttural sound, the Ayin, like that. But because Jews migrated to lands where nobody used a guttural sound like that, right? In Europe, no one's speaking like that. And J also is not really found as a letter sound in those languages. So it fell away, and they started pronouncing it just as the hard G sound. That was what you ended up with on it. So, I mean, there's more to be said about that. When I studied Arabic, it was fascinating. They have a whole bunch of sounds there that you don't see in other languages. But that's the argument. Of course, this is really interesting because you ask yourself what it says about the involvement of individual tribes of Jews with other Jews versus with their neighbors. Right? Meaning, it's true, we said, Yiftach said, that it's been 300 years since they came into the land. But I would have expected that Ephraim would have had more conversation with other Jews than they would have had with whatever Canaanim were living in the land around them. But now you're trying to tell me that their patterns of speech actually followed the people among whom they lived, as opposed to Menashe, who lives across the water, right? Who lives across the Yarden. That's really striking. Okay. Last bit on this story, he's buried in... Yeah, sorry? So, yes, if you... The way to remember it is this. The south of Israel is all Yehuda, with cities of Shimon, you know, scattered within Yehuda. North of Yehuda is Binyamin, and you always remember that because Yerushalayim is split between Yehuda and Binyamin. And then north of Binyamin is Ephraim and Menashe. That's the way I find anyway that it works. Okay. And all of them being together, Binyamin, Ephraim, Menashe, is all the Rachel families. Okay. So we say he is buried in Arei HaGilad, the cities of Gilad. So, you know, the Medrash on this recognizes that the ambiguity here is unusual, right? He's buried in the cities of Gilead instead of actually naming what city he was buried in. So we saw this, right? We saw this last week. The Medrash said that he actually suffers for what he did to his daughter. He loses limbs, and each limb is buried in a different city. So he is buried in, literally, the cities of the Gilead. I didn't notice before. Sorry, Michael. Michael wrote in the chat that Jews who grew up in London can tell which suburb another Jew comes from. Good point. I actually, I saw a video with somebody doing something like 17 different British accents. They were demonstrating all the different accents. I have a relative who's very into emulating accents, so... 17 accents. I was very impressed by that. They all sounded British to me. But the Medrash is picking up on the ambiguity of Areya Gilead, the cities of Gilead. However, Ralbag has a different take on what happened. Take a look, please, at source number 6. Ralbag writes, V'hanachon etzli, it appears correct to me, Ki yiftach mipnei shelo hishir acharav bein obat ye nikrab b'hem shemo yikarei b'hem shemo nikrab b'nosh ye nikrab b'hem shemo. Yiftach doesn't have any kids, right? We learned his only child was this daughter, so no one is going to carry his name. So tzivashi yigbaru atzmosav bechol arei gilad ktsas po. He said, I want to have, he says, this is actually his wish, graves in every city. He wants everybody to remember what he did for them, and so he wants to have memorial sites, graves, in every city. Here lies the arm of our great Savior. Right? That's what you're telling me. It's sort of like Gideon with the gold jacket. Right, according to the view that it was supposed to be a monument to his victory. Taking this view, right, this fits the general theme that we've identified again with Amon and Yiftach of trying to do something good, but doing it in a very warped way. So to conclude and to summarize what we've said about Yiftach, this is a time when, as we're going to say at the end of Shoftim, Ish Hayashar Beinav Yaseh. People do what they think is right. And you see it with Amon. That's the identity of Amon, which comes from the girl who says there have to be more children and then we have to have children with our father. It happens here with his brothers, who chase Yiftach off because he's a product of Zinut. You find it with Yiftach taking this vow, and insisting on, and his daughter insisting on, having her either killed or sacrificed in some other way. We also get it with Yiftach versus Ephraim that we learned about today, and possibly the burial according to Ralbag's read of it. All of that emerges from this story. The other pieces that we can learn from, I think, are taking vows be'et tzara, taking vows in a time of need. That it is a value of ours, although again, here goes wildly wrong. The problem of ignorance or stubbornness that leads to the fate of Yiftach's daughter, right? Because we gave a whole bunch of explanations for what happens to her, but at bottom, most views come back to that. Either ignorance or stubbornness. And Ephraim's ingratitude and their hubris, and Yiftach's rash reaction. Yeah, unless you are to take Abarbanel's defense of him, that it's because they threatened to burn his house down. So, what we get after this are three mini-accounts of Shoftim. We had Tola and Yair in the 10th Perek, and now we get Ibtzan, Elon, and Avdon. But realistically, we're not going to wrap this today. I sort of wonder whether we should just hold this until after Pesach, because we don't meet next week. I'm not doing it the night of Bedikas Chametz. And then the week after that will be Yantif. So maybe we should pick up with this on the 21st? All right, good. So then, yes, God willing, we'll pick up with that on the 21st. Everyone should please stay well, stay isolated, and... a chag bari and a chag kasher v'sameach.
Thank you. Thank you for
having me. Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you.